Welcome back to Alaska Voices. We spent a year gathering place-based conversations about Alaska, Alaskans, and Arctic issues.
We collected stories from all around the state, and sometimes outside the state, with no prompting provided beyond, please talk about what's on your mind. The only requirement was that two people had to have some sort of an Alaskan experience.
Sometimes we listened to two friends recalling a memorable experience, sometimes two leaders sharing their visions for their communities, and sometimes two scientists talking about the changes they've seen in the systems they study.
But most of all, we just listened and let the conversation develop naturally. By the time we brought everything back to our base in Fairbanks, we had dozens of hours of recordings.
We ended up with a body of knowledge with links to a wide variety of communities, professions, and walks of life. And when we clipped out pieces to share, we checked back with everyone to make sure we understood what they said and held true to the spirit of their conversation.
We're starting with four of our favorite conversations to give you an idea of what inspired Alaska Voices, then and now, both as scientists and as humans.
Let's start off by playing the short piece that launched our podcast. Bob and I recorded a conversation titled Introducing Alaska Voices, which Kelsey Skonberg edited.
I want to learn more and have you talk about where this project started and how it came about.
You and I were at AGU, the American Geophysical Union annual meeting, and it was in December 2016. And it has, 25,000 attendees, and it's just a lot. And I find that I can't really absorb information after a while. And I just remember thinking, I just want somebody to tell me a story about their work, about anything related to their science. And I remember bringing up StoryCorps and thinking, wow, that would be really neat to do kind of a science-based StoryCorps. And then we just started marching forward. And I remember contacting StoryCorps when I got back and having conversations with them. And then we wanted to set up a community recording, like a community recording project, and get facilitators on board. And you sought out funding from the Alaska Climate Science Adaptation Center.
Yep. I guess the other thing, we called it science tapes originally. We had to fix that because it just wasn't working in terms of getting people to talk to us.
And then we rounded up our facilitators and we tried to get as diverse group as possible in terms of like what communities people interact with and where people work and where they're from and different perspectives. And then the facilitator essentially sits there with microphones and makes sure the sound is working and gets everyone oriented toward the recording and sets up expectations and gets paperwork and all that. At the training, we recorded six conversations as practice. I originally was wondering if it would be kind of boring to sit and not say a word for 40 minutes, but it's actually really enthralling. These conversations had their arcs, you know, so they'd talk about a lot of like really deep things for a little bit, and then they'd move surface level and deep. I went home that Friday night and just cried. I just realized that I think I'd been really missing something in my professional life. So I guess the humanity in people is one of the things I think we miss out on a lot. You've worked a lot on inclusivity in science, and we've talked a lot about what is missing and why do we lose people and why do people not even come into science. And through this process, I've wondered if that humanity piece is missing for people.
Do you still wonder about that?
I do. I think science isn't very accommodating to a lot of different personality types. There's a lot of uncertainty, and it's usually a lot of juggling a lot of balls in the air and trying to stay employed. I think it's easy for people to lose track of each other a little bit.
A lot of us are introverts and quite guarded with our thoughts and feelings and, you know, what we're thinking about day to day. When we were at that meeting in Anchorage, the Alaska Forum on the Environment, people came in from all over the state. We thought that'd be a great opportunity to record. And at first, people were really hesitant, even though we gave a demonstration and talked about our goals and what we were intending. And the way it kind of spread, by the end, people were like rushing us to try to get us to record. Like, so many people had a story that they wanted to tell, and everybody has a story to tell. whether or not they choose to tell it or not, but everybody has a story and everybody has a background. And that came through pretty loudly in that meeting.
There's a lot of gaining consent through every part of this process. People could withdraw consent at any point. Oftentimes the partners knew each other. What I heard some of the participants say is that you don't get to sit and just talk to somebody for 40 minutes, like intensely talk to somebody. One of my favorites that stands out is Lance and Ryan. Lance interfaced with a lot of researchers and just how like ridiculous research is sometimes and how ridiculous scientists are sometimes. Because we are, we're ridiculous and it's funny.
The thing that I've really admired about you since I've known you was your vision. You always had like this really clear understanding and the ideas. The vision itself is like something that I've never been really, really good at.
Thank you. I appreciate that. One thing I've always liked about you is your ability to assemble. You're like, okay, what are we trying to do? Okay, you know what we need? We need a this person and a that person and maybe that person. And then we put all this together.
Well, I'm an engineer by training, kinda. And so to me, it's always like solving a puzzle. Like, what are the different jigsaw pieces to make this whole vision that you have actually be a picture? And I enjoy that part. I don't like creating the picture. I like putting it together.
I'm going to say a thank you to Kelsey Skonberg, who did all of our editing and did it all in a very thoughtful way with all of our interaction with the participants. And then also thank all of the participants who shared their time and their stories and conversations and their willingness to share.
After listening to our conversation again, what thoughts come to your mind? Is there anything that wasn't said that you would like to talk about?
It's been so cool to see this project take flight with the support of so many people. A simple idea can grow into something big if people believe in it. So I work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the Agricultural and Forestry Experiment Station. There's a lot of interdisciplinary work that goes on there. And as an ecologist, I focus on how the boreal forest interacts with permafrost and climate and impacts Alaskan landscapes and, by extension, us as Alaskans. My colleagues in Cooperative Extension turn research into information the public can use, so it makes sense that I'm interested in making science accessible to everybody.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think science and scientists can be inaccessible because we get stuck in our heads and are focused on finding money to support research or writing up papers that are focused on the science community. I'm drawn to hearing the stories behind the data, like a single data point has hours, days, or weeks of work behind it. The data point also has stories of encountering wildlife, four-wheelers breaking down, or research stations that are destroyed by wildlife. A single data point is a wealth of stories that no one ever hears, but we can share them here. And, I mean, we have more than science stories, which is what has made this project so fun and interesting. We started with the idea of science stories, but ended up branching out to hearing from people about their experiences on the landscape, with friends, family, or coworkers, and sharing a bit of themselves with us. So, Bob, what are your thoughts after hearing this?
Well, I really enjoyed the human part of this project. We originally brought 12 people together with very different backgrounds from Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. We had science communicators, we had at least one gardener, an engineer, some lifelong Alaskans, and some people that were relatively new to Alaska, people from the rural villages and communities, and some that primarily lived here in the cities. We all brought something different to the table. I don't want to speak for anybody else, but from the types of conversations that our group recorded, it was obvious that we all see the world through different sets of eyes. I call myself a permafrost hydrologist, which is pretty specific. However, working at the International Arctic Research Center and being part of the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center has given me the chance to work closely with many different groups of people, both locally and in more rural parts of Alaska. We've spent a lot of time working on and thinking about how we can communicate what we do to the broader community. This is something we are not necessarily good at. And right now, I don't think any of us are really good at listening to each other. I think that's a big reason why I'm drawn to this project. I'm also really drawn to the idea of perspectives, how two people can look at the same thing but experience it in a very different way. An example of this, and a conversation I have always really wanted to record, is having a sea ice scientist have a conversation with a person that relies on sea ice for their livelihood or survival. For example, for hunting or travel or protection or winter storms or whatever the case may be. Two people who look at a big chunk of ice and have a conversation about what that ice means to them. Do you remember the time when we went out to the field to talk about ideas? I think it must have been around 2009 or 10. I can't exactly remember, but I know it was a fall day.
Yeah, I remember that day. I think we brought my dog. I was learning a new ecosystem since my degree was about working in the desert. I wasn't sure how that knowledge would transfer to a new place. And it was really fun trying to integrate my new understanding of the ecology of this place with your knowledge about hydrology. I recall it being a fun day that opened up a lot of new possibilities. We still have our sites out there and I check on them to download data. And I've gotten to see the changes to the landscape over the past 10 years, which speaks to the importance of observing the land over a long time.
Yeah, the thing I really remember about that day is how we climbed up the hill slope, just looking out across the valley to the other side. We sat there for a good while and just talked to each other about what we were looking at and explaining why we were looking at each thing and what it meant to us. At that point in my science career, I had not really thought about how the work you do could, should, or might impact the science questions I was trying to answer. I knew that vegetation and ecology had a role on the permafrost and the hydrology, but I had diminished its role in my mind as I was so narrowly looking at my questions through my point of view of the world. That conversation completely changed my perspective on how I view the world and the science that I do. Everything is really connected.
I agree with you on that. I had a similar experience. That day stays in my memory as a perfect example of how to start building understanding. You start at the bottom, go for a walk, and build the base before moving up.
Yeah, I think that's why I really like the part of our mission statement that says, Alaska Voices builds bridges. We all have a perspective, and these conversations help me bridge those perspectives. I think it also reminds me of how we are all connected, even if we don't realize that we are.
I like how the simple nature of having and sharing conversations builds relationships, like our experience in the watershed that day. In this project, listening to people who know each other share space and conversation was powerful for them and for the person recording it. Conversation and quiet listening without interruption is the simplest and most powerful way to build understanding and share knowledge.
So our next two conversations that we're going to share with you are two of our favorites. Do you want to introduce the next one?
Sure. Next, we'll hear a conversation between Dr. Uma Bhatt and Dr. Peter Bienick, who are atmospheric scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Uma was Peter's mentor in grad school, and now they are colleagues. They talk about what it is to be a scientist and the role of creativity, collaborating with community members on interpreting their data, and how the busyness of the profession makes it hard to imagine. This piece is titled A Professional Life and was recorded by me and edited by Teresa Bacher.
I was one of those kids that was always into weather, and I grew up in, you know, in the Detroit area in Michigan in the Midwest, where we have pretty variable weather just from, you know, day to day. I think when I was little, my parents said I'd call them tomato warnings instead of tornado warnings. So
did you have a teacher that inspired you, a science teacher, or your parents, or it just happened?
It just kind of happened. For me, I was always watching the sky. I didn't really know anything about Alaska climate science when I first came up, just like meteorology did that. Like, I didn't really know much about meteorology, but then, you know, I started taking the classes.
Because you were originally not necessarily interested in climate.
Yeah, not originally at all. I was totally wanted to be a weather forecaster, one of those downstairs, you know, down here in this building with meteorology stuff.
What's the thing you enjoyed doing most about your research?
Well, especially early on, I really loved calculating stuff. But oddly enough, now I've decided that I'm starting to really grow to enjoy thinking about and planning science and writing proposals. I know that's kind of an ironic thing.
That is ironic since I went to bed at 4:30 this morning because I'm working on a proposal.
Yeah, I know, and I know that's.
But it was actually fun.
Yeah, maybe we're a good fit then, actually,
this job.
We enjoy it. That's really what I love about this business is just that it's always about the kind of the dream and the ideas and the imagination.
Where do you see things going in the next few decades?
I definitely don't think we should stay in the status quo, perhaps, that we are. It would be nice if we came into some kind of renaissance where scientists can be scientists. I feel like we're always scrambling for funds these days, or at least that's a big part of it now. It would be nice if we could go back to the more of the philosophy again, maybe. And
Time to imagine.
Time to imagine.
Yeah. I feel that a lot of younger people really don't want to be faculty and don't want to be scientists because they feel very fed up with the system. And I am actually really worried about that. Mm-hmm. Peter and I are working on a ton of different projects. Yeah. So right now we're trying to apply seasonal forecasts to predicting quantities that can be useful for fire managers. But seasonal forecasts are still in their infancy, so we're really struggling. It's a real challenge, but it's also very exciting to do some science that is very useful in the very short run. You found in one of the papers from your PhD was that vegetation was browning in southwestern Alaska, the tundra vegetation, and it's greening just about everywhere else throughout the Arctic. And having that opportunity to talk to local elders about what they've seen over their lifetime, one of the things you and I have enjoyed the most, being able to go back and tell them about the analysis that you'd done.
Oh, I agree. That was and especially since we literally didn't speak the same language.
Oh, because everything went through the translator. Yeah, and the elders gave us some ideas on what we could look at with the data. You know, I think it's actually fantastic that you've stayed here. Like, even if you had finished your PhD and left, I think we wouldn't have made all this headway that we've since you in the last when did you graduate? 4 years ago?
Five years ago.
Yeah. In these 5 years, I think we've just made so much headway on a variety of different projects mm-hmm. that just take a lot of time to do. And so anything that involves people just takes a lot more time, as opposed to, I think, the way science was, you know, more traditionally done, where you sat in your office and you did your work and you didn't really interact with other people except to talk about the science. So when IARC first started, we had probably like 10 or 15 scientists, and we used to spend a lot of time when it looked like we weren't doing any work. Some of the most creative things came out of those interactions. And one of our Russian colleagues came back to visit us like 10 years later, and he said, you know, you guys are so busy with busy work that you guys don't have the time to imagine right now. And Igor Polyakov and I both said, yes, you're right. You know, I solve a lot of my research problems when I'm doing these other things, right?
Usually it's not when you're sitting at the desk against a deadline, actually. It's when you're out doing something or
you have
listening to a song or whatever, you know.
Did you always do this? I feel like I didn't start doing this till I suddenly bought into, okay, I'm going to be a scientist and I'm throwing myself into it. I think once you commit, then your free time, you're actually thinking about these scientific issues.
Thanks for sharing that, Jesse. I'm curious to know, what about that piece resonated with you? Why did you choose that?
I like this conversation because I remember sitting in on the recording. I watched the two of them drop into the discussion about imagination and creativity as some of the most important parts of being a scientist, and it was really endearing. I mean, one of our goals of this entire project was to humanize science and scientists, and we had these two beautiful humans sharing this conversation. But it also reminded me why I became a scientist. It's because the creativity and imagination that went into dreaming up the critical question and finding the answer is really inspiring.
Next, we will hear a conversation between Dr. Joanna Young and Dr. Erin Pettit. Erin is the founder and director of Inspiring Girls Expeditions, former faculty at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and is now at Oregon State University. Their conversation is about their experiences with the Girls on Ice and Inspiring Girls programs, as well as navigating a non-traditional graduate school program and career. I originally asked Erin and Joanna to record their conversation after watching the science presentations for one of the Girls on Ice expeditions that had just concluded. This piece is titled Partnerships and is recorded by Jesse Robertson and produced by Teresa Bacher.
I'm Joanna Young. I'm 33 years old. My relationship to my partner, interview partner Erin here, is I am her graduate student, her employee, her mentee, and also her friend.
My name is Erin Pettit, and I am 45 years old, and we are here in Fairbanks, Alaska, and my relationship to my interview partner, Joanna, is that I'm her advisor and mentor for both science and educational activities, leadership activities, and her friend.
I anticipated coming in and doing a pretty straightforward science-only, glaciology-only degree for a master's, and it's now been 7 years, and I'm well into a PhD and an outreach program that Erin and I work on together called Girls on Ice, and it's given me an opportunity to work on outdoor education and leadership and just an art and this overwhelming number of different topics that I don't think I would have gotten to explore as part of my graduate student experience, or I didn't expect to anyway. And I'm just really happy that now I'm studying all of those things in a formal way and not just kind of dabbling on the side and feeling like it's not part of my real job and I should be focusing on just the science. Like, these are an actual part of my graduate student experience now.
Has it been a little bit scary going sort of a non-traditional PhD route?
I'm nodding. Yeah, it has been scary. The person I had to convince more than anyone else was myself that these other endeavors are worthwhile and are actually the stuff that I feel passionate about and probably excel at more than just the sitting and doing data analysis all the time, which I also love. But I think my passion is more broad than that. And there have been some naysayers, I think, along the way. I've gotten some like anonymous articles placed on my cubicle desk with the headline that says, you know, the dangers of diversifying your skill set too young in your graduate studies. And I'm like, what is this supposed to imply? Well, I'm pretty sure I know what it's supposed to imply. So there, you know, there are traditionalists and people who see graduate studies, I think, for one specific purpose. And I just don't agree with that.
And so how do you think your balance of Alaskan science, glacier science specifically, and Alaskan youth education is already benefiting the state of Alaska as a whole and our struggles with trying to understand the future of climate change and how to deal with it in Alaska?
Right.
That's a big question. That's loaded. Sorry.
I'll try to tackle it. Let's go deep. I think that scientific information is incredibly valuable, but it's not valuable in and of itself sitting on a dusty bookshelf somewhere. And the findings that we come up with, the results that we generate, are only so useful as how it ultimately impacts policy. And we can't impact policy if we don't have people on board with the message. And one of the ways I think that we do that with Girls on Ice and with this outreach endeavor is that we take youth when they're at this pivotal moment in their lives, 16 and 17 years old, and we bring them from places where they may or may not see the impacts of climate change on their home landscape, and we bring it to the forefront, and we show them the very visible signs on the landscape of these impacts. And I have to believe that those girls go home and talk to their parents and talk to their siblings and talk to their friends, and that it becomes a topic of conversation, and that we're contributing to a wider dialogue around the state. Can I ask you a question, Erin?
Sure.
Did you envision having graduate students who would walk away with such a broad range of skill sets? And do you ever struggle with your graduate students kind of wanting to diversify and maybe taking longer than they could?
I've always had the impression that graduate school should be the training that the student will benefit most from. And that's different than them just being a research assistant on a specific project beginning to end, and then you're out. You know, even when I was in graduate school, I took that picture of graduate school is a body of work that should include some teaching experience, some networking with understanding the whole scientific community and how all of that works, as well as the specifics of a particular project. And maybe you'd work on a couple of different projects depending on the skill set you want to create. And since that was kind of the philosophy I took with my own graduate degree, I can't really tell my students not to do that. And I know there are some advisors that really want to push the student towards a very specific beginning to end project because that's the most efficient way to get through with a PhD. But if you really want to do something beyond the PhD, you need to have skill sets beyond processing data. So far, I have not received a lot of fallback from my students being sometimes a little more diverse. And not all of my students have been that way. So I try to also make sure that my students realize they can do it the way that they want.
I have a big picture loaded question. I'd be curious, what do you think is good leadership?
Good leadership can take many forms, I think, actually. But maybe the core of it is recognizing that as a leader, you're not there to tell other people what to do. You're there to support them succeeding at what they already can do best or helping them learn to do something better. But I think being aware of the dynamics among the people that are involved, being aware and open to understanding the different skill sets that everybody brings in, and not making the assumption that you as the leader know the right answer and the right direction to go. So it's all about all of us stepping away from our egos and gently kind of encouraging everybody to do a little bit of that.
I was reading a paper recently that talked about recommendations on how to reward, well, this was even talking about scientific publications, but scientific publications that are built off of bringing in community members, like either doing citizen science or incorporating traditional ecological knowledge and co-production of knowledge, essentially. The paper was suggesting these types of studies take twice the amount of time. You know, that type of work to actually have that kind of impact outside of just the paper takes twice as much time. So shouldn't those publications be worth twice as much as all the others when you're applying for a tenure package?
It's a very difficult thing. And I honestly, it's difficult for me to say in a public space, but the entire Girls on Ice, Inspiring Girls Expedition thing has made my career path much more difficult than it would have if I had not done this at all. And so I have to constantly be basically just accepting the risk that it has added to my career path in terms of choices of faculty positions or to get what I want. And UAF has actually been really wonderful with it, but many universities have struggled with it. And I kind of went into it knowing that it was going to make my life difficult. Mm-hmm. But seeing what happens to these girls and engaging all of these women in the process has just been so much more powerful of an experience for me that it was worth it to take those risks with my own career. Still scares me every day, though, that I, yeah.
Well, from me to you, thanks for doing that on behalf of the girls and on behalf of people like me.
Well, thank you for being a very determined student who was willing to persevere through a lot of challenges.
Curious, what about this piece resonated with you?
I really I asked Aaron and Joanna to record this conversation because I've always thought that the Girls on Ice program and the Inspiring Girls program was by far the coolest program on campus. And I really related to the non-traditional route of going through graduate school and the obstacles that it presents. I also had sort of a non-traditional route in my graduate career, and so I really appreciated that. I was also very fortunate in having a fantastic mentor who I met very early in my graduate career, and that's benefited me greatly over time.
So these two conversations that we just played share the theme of the struggle for more time. In both of these pieces, they share that when we collaborate with community members on projects, these experiences are enriching and they're wonderful, but they take more time. And we're always up against time. We're too busy to imagine and sometimes even to include more voices in this profession.
The more we recorded, the more we realized that many of our participants had commonalities or shared similar experiences with each other. Plenty of people had stories about being out on the land or in the field. Several chose to compare notes on the changes they'd experienced during their time in Alaska. A lot of students and researchers talked about the barriers they'd faced in academia and the changes they'd like to see in order to remove those barriers. We started organizing the conversations by these common threads. We also made sure every piece is its own contained story as well, sometimes as short as a single anecdote, and sometimes a tale that spans decades and generations. One of our longer pieces covers many of these themes while maintaining the incredibly strong through lines of family, loss, and legacy. We'll play that conversation after a short introduction from its recorder and editor, Nathan Bells.
Hi, I'm Nathan Bells. A couple of years ago, I sat down with Luke and Teal Rogers. Teal, already a small business owner before she had turned 23, runs Golden Heart Performing Arts and works part-time as the outdoor programs coordinator for REI. Luke, an experienced rafter and recreationalist, was conducting wildlife biology research on bison as an undergraduate at UAF at the time, and is now pursuing a master's degree at the University of Nebraska. Their love for adventure, the outdoors, and bison was instilled in them in part by their father, Randy Rogers, who passed away in 2013 after a courageous battle with cancer. During his life, Randy worked tirelessly to reintroduce wood bison into the wilds of Alaska through his roles at the Department of Fish and Game and the Northern Environmental Center. Unfortunately, he was never able to see the release of the wood bison to which he had committed himself and his career. The story they shared with me was about how they carry their father with them and the love that he had for the wilderness and wildlife of Alaska. This episode is titled, Remembering Randy, Restoring the Bison.
Hi, my name is Teal Rogers. It's currently August 4th, 2017. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska with my brother Luke Rogers. And in the middle of the table, we have a miniature bison figurine. And can't quite tell if it's a plains bison or a woods bison, but it's just a little baby bison, about the size of a quarter. So I keep this one in my purse. I put it on my dashboard when I'm driving. I've taken this bison to New Zealand with me. Plan on taking him on a lot of other adventures. Keeps us remembering about the herd and dad all the time. We grew up here in Fairbanks in the interior of Alaska, and when we were kids, we found ourselves down south of Anchorage into a small town called Portage. And our friends, our family friends, Mike and Kelly Miller, own the property, and they've started kind of a program to rehabilitate animals that might have been, someone might have taken them from their natural habitat, and then they needed a place to live since they lost all of their outdoor skills. Sometimes there was just too many foxes out on the airport runways, and they needed to put them somewhere. So it's a wildlife habitat, and we kind of grew up there. We got to meet animals. There was moose. There was interns teaching and working and learning with the moose. We had wolverines there. The animals kind of come and go. So we kind of grew up at the conservation center, and our dad was a volunteer between the Department of Fish and Game and the Wildlife Conservation Center to start working on a wood bison restoration project. And do you remember when Dad, like, he started going over to Canada? Mm-hmm. Our father, Randy Rogers, was a wood bison biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
He was a wildlife planner.
Wildlife planner.
He didn't do the biology side of it as much, but he did a lot of the logistics behind getting the animals here and jumping through the regulatory hoops that are required to bring an animal from a different country into the United States.
So he brought us into the Wildlife Conservation Center, and we just kind of hung out with Mike and Kelly, and then they had kids. And I would definitely credit Dad for giving us that sense of adventure and wanting to go outside and be outside and to also take others with us. So he was just all the time outdoor, wanting to get us rafting and hiking, take us somewhere to go play.
They all kind of blended together. I didn't really care to pay attention to what specific river we were on or what specific trip we were doing, but it all just was another wilderness trip to me. You know, we'd spend about a week every summer.
And we'd bring another family or two with us and head out to go rafting.
Whether it was the mighty Copper River or just a nice, gentle Beaver Creek flow. One that I remember pretty well was the 40-mile river float we did, which is over in a rural spot of Alaska near Chicken. Interesting little town of Chicken, Alaska, which we go to a music festival at every year now.
There's seven people is the census population.
Yeah.
The town of seven, Chicken, Alaska.
It was a nice couple week float and beautiful weather most of the time, I remember. And we went up to this point where there was the big rapids on the river. And I remember a man coming up to us in a boat and saying, "You better strap your kids in," and looking at me as a little 4 or 5 year old kid. And my sister being only like 9 or 10 by then. And so strapping your kids into a raft is never a very good idea. Especially if it flips.
So the kid's gonna drown.
We didn't take this very literally, and I remember going through the rapids, and we would just hold our hands up like we were riding a roller coaster. We had no fear at all because we knew our dad could handle himself and
navigate
the
water
straight.
Yeah.
So that was a good experience that I remember, and my dad being able to guide us through some really exciting whitewater.
Yeah. Well, I think I totally feel that way when I'm in a raft with you now, Luke. I know that you have that sense of safety and security and that you're going to make a right move over a wrong move. Luke, you want to paint a picture of what Dad looks like?
Yeah, I guess when I remember him best, he was kind of this very old, jolly, almost Santa Claus looking guy. He had a big white beard, some glasses, and he was somewhat bald but had the nice white patches on the sides of his head.
He had a gut on him, but he was full of muscle.
Yeah, he had a good sized belly, but definitely he was still very well in shape. He worked very hard, and you could always just see like a very happy, upbeat attitude on him. He never looked upset much.
Yeah. My mom always says this too. If you took a side profile of Randy, he looks just like a bison. You could see it maybe if you squint your eyes a little bit, but he's definitely become part of the face of the Wood Bison Restoration Project. And our dad did recently pass away from esophageal cancer. And in that time, I was a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and my brother was just finishing up his high school years when we lost him. And it was definitely rough for us. It was hard. We were at least able to see it coming, and we didn't know when it would happen, but we were able to spend the last few years of my dad's life shredding the mountains and rafting with them and going out on adventures. He literally was skiing 3 weeks before he passed away, so I think he made the most of it, and he taught us well. But that kind of brings me to, like, you, Luke. Let's talk about some bison.
So the whole project started in the early 90s. There was a man named Bob Stevenson, a brilliant biologist, who was working in the Yukon Flats as the area biologist. And he had found a lot of these different bison skulls over there while he was out fishing and doing other census and things for animals. So Bob Stevenson found that there was bison there recently, as recent as 150 years ago. And he kind of was wondering, well, maybe if we brought them back, it'd be another food source for these people. He really cared and loved the native Alaskans that lived in that region. So he kind of started heading this project to potentially bring bison back to Alaska. It wasn't long until he realized that he wasn't able to do it on his own, and that's kind of when my dad came in. Bob Stevenson would head the biology portion of it and the logistics of actually bringing the animals in, and my dad would work with the people that would influence it, so state and federal managers, and work with the Canadians to potentially bring some wood bison over. So he became the planner, the person in charge of all the political aspect of it, I guess you could say. So in about the early to mid-2000s, we ended up bringing 60 to 70 wood bison over from Elk Island National Park in Canada. They were trucked all the way over to the Alaska Wildlife Conservation Center, which I think took about a week or so to do.
It wasn't easy. Dad would come home every night talking about what was going on politically with the program, and some days would be better than others, and big battles, small words, big battles, just trying to get potential places for the bison. And how do you fence in a bison that weighs over 2,000 pounds? It's not easy. They can break down anything. And we knew it wasn't going to be like a flash turnaround when they came from Canada. We knew we had to have them in captivity for a little bit, but make sure that all the sampling was good and that they were living healthy and that they could adjust to Alaska.
And so they ended up staying there a little bit longer than they were expecting them to. It was expected to be about 3 or 4 years.
Right, they were supposed to be released in 2010, right?
Mm-hmm, that was the original release date.
And it's 2000.
It wasn't 2017. It wasn't 2015. No. Almost 10 years until they were released.
Right. We would visit the bison frequently. I mean, the conservation center was kind of like our home away from home. We knew we could go there anytime. And but those bison, you can't really name them. There's just too many of them. And I think you, Luke, are probably the most knowledgeable about each and every one of those bison that are still there. Studying them for research.
Yeah, that's recently, and I'll get to that here in a minute. I wanted to try to finish the story of the bison reintroduction because it's a very long one that you can easily get off track, and we have multiple times already.
I'm sorry.
Anyways, it was about 2013 that Bob Stevenson had kind of left the project for the wood bison, and as well, my father had passed away. It was almost kind of seemed like the end of the potential for the Wood Bison Project without either of its leaders. So a man named Tom Seaton, who's the current project biologist, he came in and he kind of became the new face of the reintroduction. And so it was in 2015, actually the fall of 2014, that Governor Sean Parnell finally gave the okay for the release of the wood bison.
Woohoo!
That was about 6 months before they had to do it. So now you've been waiting for 10 years to get these bison onto the landscape, and you finally got the okay, and you have 6 months to bring 130 2,000-pound animals over 150 miles from the largest city in Alaska, Anchorage, all the way over to one of the most rural and remote areas in all of Alaska. So they had to be landed in Shagaluk. It's in the southwest area of Alaska. It's
north of Bethel.
It's in the Gash region. It's mostly characterized by the fact that you have the giant Yukon River there, multiple other drainages there, and lots of low-lying flats. That is just perfect bison territory. They were able to secure the funding. They decided to take these individuals in two separate loads. First was in the spring of 2015. They took 100 females and calves, young animals, by plane in C-130 Hercules. They had to get a special FAA clearance to land them on a small gravel airstrip.
This is like in the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere.
Small rural Alaska. You can only fly in. There's no roads to get here.
Yeah. And it took about 3 hours from being at AWCC to getting to the airport at Anchorage to loading them up in the Hercules, flying them over to Shagaluk, and releasing them into what we called a soft release, which is a small pen that they're kind of kept in for about 2 to 3 weeks while they get familiar with the land, and then they're released later on when they're kind of more relaxed and ready to go. Later on, when they did the males, which was in the summer of 2015, they did a barge, or two separate barges, from Nenana, Alaska, which is in the interior.
So they drove them from the Wildlife Conservation Center.
6 hours up to Nenana, and then they loaded them onto these barges in these shipping containers. These are big males, the biggest animals in the Western Hemisphere. And then they had to boat them down the Yukon, which is the largest river in Alaska, which took about 3 days. I monitored air conditioning units. It was actually some of the hottest days that summer, which can be pretty dangerous for these large furry animals that are in a conex. Spray them down, put the air conditioning units on, make sure they were kept and well fed, and wait until they brought the other load so that they can bring them down there. They just released those wood bison over there, and the females and the young calves had already been released for about 2 to 3 months by that point. They made their way over to the other herd without a problem. They were miles away from them.
What made you think that you were interested in bison like Dad is? What inspired you so much to fall in love with the animals?
Well, I'd always heard a lot about them from my dad, and that was pretty inspiring in its own right. But I think what really happened was I came into college thinking I was going to be an engineer. I had also just come back from a couple months backpacking all throughout Europe, and I kind of had become a little bit more in love with nature at that point too, because I realized that there's a lot of people over there and a lot of cities, and I really appreciated that aspect of Alaska, not having so much of that and having a lot more wide open spaces that didn't have people in them. It was through the connections of my father that I kind of got to the point where I'm at. And I'm very grateful for that. I think I'm kind of following in his footsteps in the fact that I want to see wood bison succeed and flourish across the state of Alaska. But perhaps in a little bit of a different capacity, I want to do that as biology-oriented, research-oriented. Pretty much once I was helping with the releases of these animals and spending all this time next to them, I knew that this is what I wanted to do for my life work. Of course, that doesn't sound like the most beautiful fairy tale Disney story you've ever heard, but it is kind of the reality.
I really just cherish that Luke got to have those experiences and that I got to be there with you and to watch those bison. I, of course, didn't have to spend all that time watching them, but to be there with you, and it always felt like Dad was there with us while we did that, too. He was always around watching the bison. I think Dad's so proud of you, and I know that Mom and I are very proud of you, and just keep trekking with those bison if that's where it's calling you. Love you.
Thanks.
Hey, Luke, we missed you. On the, we stopped to go up Chair 6. I went to the bottom. Where'd you go? Wombeat up at the lodge? Give me a call, or Teal. Bye.
Our next program will be about fieldwork in Alaska, which is always an adventure in problem solving, from animal encounters to chewed up wires to moose damage sensors.
We thank you for sharing your time with us today and hope you're able to join us in our next edition of Alaska Voices. I'm going to leave you with a short clip of Krista and Katie and their experiences with fieldwork.
Krista, when did you first find me? Did I find you or did you find me?
We met each other in the greenhouse.
Oh, that's
right. You were washing samples.
And I just spent time working with two really hardcore ladies. And I was like, I want to be one of those hardcore ladies that drives a boat down the Tanana River and slugs through the mud all day and gathers samples.
I do remember that one of the main selling points on you was you were really tough in the field and you could stand, you know, slugging through the muck.
Yeah.
Which is an important quality in a grad student.
I knew coming in as a grad student that I didn't want to do science in a vacuum. I wanted it to be meaningful for people, and that helped keep my heart filled, you know, because you can get lost in the spreadsheets, and which I enjoy, but to know that getting lost in the spreadsheets is going to help somebody someday.
Alaska Voices builds bridges by creating a space where community members, friends, policymakers, and scientists can share stories and place-based knowledge. This project was developed in partnership with StoryCorps and was funded by the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. Additional funding was provided by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor through a generous gift from the Bentley Family Trust to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Alaska Voices would not be possible without the help and efforts of an amazing group of people. Our producer and audio engineer is Kelsey Skonberg of Mossy Stone Media. Our podcast and outreach specialist is Mike DeLue. And our website designer is Carolyn Rosner.
I also want to thank the musicians whose songs we heard today in the order in which they were played. Arctic Evening by Marcel Dupriez, Friends and Apples by Alpha Hydri, Brother, Brotherhood, and Listening by Mon Plaisir, Once More With You by Loyalty Freak Music, The Siphal Branches by Axeltree, Village 2018 by Kumiku, and Solo Guitar 2 by Tapes and Tubes.
If you are interested in more conversations or information, please visit our website at alaskavoices.org. For Alaska Voices, I am Jesse Robertson.
And I'm Bob Bolton.